reasons. The main reason is the aggression that has besieged the governorate and its coast, preventing fishermen from going to the sea and obtaining adequate food. Another reason is the rising unemployment. Here is the 3-year-old Saba struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit.
The 3-year-old Saba is struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit. The United Nations warned weeks ago that at least 98,000 Yemeni children were suffering from malnutrition at record high rates. However, despite the ongoing collapse of the health system in Yemen, there has yet been no international response.
There has been a noticeable increase in the number of malnutrition cases in the past 2 months. They exceed the hospital's capacity, where we only have 12 beds. We had to receive patients in other departments, such as the emergency department, and this affects the health of children and increases the number of deaths.
The health sector in Yemen has suffered a continuous deterioration amid the Saudi-led war in the country. Saudi-led coalitions of blockade has prevented the arrival of food and medicine to millions of Yemeni children and women. The Saudi-led coalition is not only targeting the Yemeni children with airstrikes, but also violates their most basic rights, such as access to food and medicine, in a clear breach of the international humanitarian law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Al-Hudaydah.
Iran's Navy has unveiled the country's largest military vessel called Makran. It is a mobile base that can carry choppers and support the military frigates of the Iranian Army's Navy. This 228-meter auxiliary ship was in fact a trade ship, but the army changed it basically to turn into a floating port capable of carrying up to 82,000 tons of warships' needs. The support ship can also carry 5 helicopters and a battalion. It can travel for 1,000 days without having access to ports. Zereh was the other vessel unveiled by the Navy in the presence of top commanders.
The Iranian frigate called Zereh, or Armor, is an extremely useful vessel. It is very fast and powerful and can carry out its missions very well. It is equipped with advanced radars and electronic warfare facilities. Zereh can play a great role in safeguarding Iran's national interests. As the frigate is a totally indigenous one, it shows that our experts have successfully bypassed the sanctions.
Zereh is a missile-launching frigate of 47 meters length that can move at a speed of 35 nautical miles. It can launch cruise missiles up to 300 kilometers. After joining these two vessels, some sudden drills called Marine Power 99 were staged to check the readiness of the forces.
These drills were not on our agenda. The goal was to check the preparedness and quick reaction of our facilities and forces. Vessels, submarines, drones, coast-to-sea missiles were tested during this exercise, and they entered the mock danger zone extending over 600,000 kilometers.
The surface-to-surface cruise missiles, submarine and flight units of the Iranian Navy took part in the drills.
With these two vessels joining the Iranian Navy, the country's waters are safer than before, and a clear message is sent to Iran's enemies that they should never think of waging a war against the country. Human Abedi, Konarak.
As things stand, it is very unclear how many people in the EU have so far actually received a COVID-19 vaccine, how many doses are currently being sent to each of the 27 member states, and when various groups can expect to get the jab. EU lawmakers have been discussing the issue in the European Parliament.
European Union citizens have a lot less vaccines available to them than they should have. The European Commission has planned this badly. Perhaps they were too bureaucratic.
On the 15th of October last, the European Commission set out clear guidelines to encourage each government in the EU to prepare for vaccination rollout, including the need to have sufficient numbers of trained personnel.
We invite the members to reflect on making sure that the necessary infrastructure is in place, that the necessary equipment is in place, taking into account the technical specificities of the vaccines.
Despite being given 2.5 months' notice, many EU countries did not prepare. Vaccines were left in boxes instead of being put into people's arms. We have been speaking to citizens about the vaccine rollout.
Things are not that well done at the moment. I think that we lack some information about everything. People need to know.
It was too slow, but now we have vaccine, then we must quickly act.
Yeah, I think it's better to have done it safely, but I mean the price to pay is that it may take a bit longer.
More people have now been vaccinated in the UK than in all of the 27 EU member states combined.
Could we have been doing more about creating better capacity building for the manufacturing of the vaccines? And could we have done more in order to adjust the expectations from the citizens about the speediness of how we roll out these vaccines?
Some lawmakers say the credibility of the EU is being undermined by the fact that some member states, such as Germany, Denmark and Cyprus, are seeking extra vaccines outside of the European Commission's vaccine strategy. With the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna vaccines having already been approved for use in the EU, the European Medicines Agency is due to give the green light to a third, the AstraZeneca vaccine, on the 29th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's oil ministry has signed major investment agreements with domestic contractors in a bid to boost crude oil production. As part of the deals, the National Iranian South Oil Company and the Iranian Offshore Oil Company agreed to contract out major onshore projects in four oil-rich provinces, as well as offshore projects in the Persian Gulf, to domestic companies. The projects are worth $1.2 billion. Oil Minister Bijan Namdar Zanganeh says this is the last stage of a plan that aims to boost Iran's crude output by some 300,000 barrels a day.
We have pursued this plan since a few years ago, and today the 31st contract was signed. The agreements will ramp up the output by increasing the recovery factor of our oil fields. This is estimated to add about $1.5 billion annually to our total oil income.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. The country's oil production has almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day since U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal and reimposed unilateral oil embargoes on Iran 3 years ago. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels a day, down from 2.5 million. Zanganeh says Iran plans to increase its oil production by more than twofold next year, to 4.5 million barrels per day.
Due to the sanctions, the share of oil exports in our annual budget has slashed by 14%, but the restrictions have pushed us to discover new domestic capacities to keep the oil industry afloat. All of these contracts have been signed with Iranian contractors. Furthermore, over 70% of the needed equipment are manufactured indigenously. We are not going to relinquish our domestic capacities in the oil industry, even if the sanctions are lifted.
Last year, oil exports accounted for 35% of Iran's budget. Along with the U.S. sanctions, the coronavirus pandemic has also squeezed Iran's oil revenues by cutting global demand.
While Iran is poised to make a strong comeback to the oil market, officials say crude revenues will cover only 25% of the country's next year budget, despite a projected rise in exports. This is Tehran is making a strategic shift to non-oil revenues to shield the economy from the ups and downs of its petroleum sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Leaders of Russia, Armenia and Azerbaijan set for talks in the Russian capital Moscow to discuss the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh. The negotiations lasted about 4 hours, during which Russian President Vladimir Putin called for resolving issues connected with the peacekeeping operation, as well as clarification of demarcation lines, humanitarian problems and protection of cultural heritage sites.
Today we can note with satisfaction that trilateral agreements are applied in practice. We believe that it creates necessary conditions for a full-fledged settlement of the old conflict on the just basis in the interests of both Azeri and Armenian nations.
Putin thanked Aliyev and Pashinyan for the fact that they positively perceived the active mediation actions of Russia aimed at stopping the bloodshed and stabilizing the situation. After 6 weeks of deadly fighting in and around Karabakh in September, Yerevan and Baku eventually agreed on November 9th to end hostilities under a Moscow broker deal that secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan in Karabakh and seven surrounding districts. The situation seems calm, with the exchange of prisoners and bodies of the dead carried out smoothly.
I believe that the key to success is to put an end to the presence of non-regional players such as France and the US. Experience shows that integration of regional players lead to great achievements. As we saw in the case of Syria, regional conflicts are resolved only when regional players sit for talks.
Following the trilateral talks in the Kremlin, the parties signed a joint statement on the development of Nagorno-Karabakh. To this end, it was decided that a plan be presented in the near future by the deputy prime ministers of Russia, Azerbaijan and Armenia.
2 months have passed since the ceasefire was signed. Our presence here shows that we are determined to fulfill the commitments made in September and November.
Unfortunately, today we couldn't resolve the issue of war prisoners. This is the most sensitive and painful issue. We agreed to continue our cooperation in this area. We believe that the 8th paragraph of our joint statement has not yet been fully implemented. I hope we could make a concrete decision as soon as possible.
As part of the ceasefire, nearly 2,000 Russian peacekeepers have stationed along the Lachin Corridor in Azerbaijan, a 60 kilometers long route that links Khankendi to Armenia.
According to the Russian Ministry of Defense, by January 10th, over 48,000 refugees from Armenia returned to the region. The Russian department conducts round-the-clock monitoring of the situation and the ceasefire in the region. In addition, deepening work continues. Марина Картунова, Москва.
In less than 2 weeks, Democrat Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. But unlike the country's much-touted slogan of peaceful transition of power, nothing within the country seems peaceful. The capital, Washington, D.C., saw unprecedented fatal riots on the Capitol building. It all began after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump attacked Congress during its meeting to certify Biden's win in the November election. Officials have blamed Trump for inciting the violence as he kept refusing for months to concede defeat. They say U.S. democracy is in danger. President Trump now faces threats of impeachment just days before his tenure comes to an end. House Democrats have already drafted articles of impeachment against Trump over the Wednesday insurrection. The draft was prepared after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Trump to resign immediately. She also urged the invocation of the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment calls for the removal of a president who is unable to discharge his official duties. Trump has been shunned by many members of his own Republican Party as well. President-elect Biden has also called him one of the most incompetent presidents in U.S. history. Outside the country, world leaders, including Washington's allies, have criticized Trump's supporters' attack on Capitol Hill.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters, incited by the current president and other politicians. Violence has no place in our societies, and extremists will not succeed in overruling the will of the people.
Britain has reacted too.
What President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
France criticized the Capitol riot, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel blamed Trump for sharing the blame. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro called the violence a reflection of what Washington has been using to do with other countries.
What we see that Donald Trump did, without a doubt, is what they're used to doing with the countries of the world. These same poor rural whites are the ones one sees dressed up as Superman invading Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Panama, and Grenada.
The U.S. has always regarded itself as the bastion of democracy in the world. Now, the recent chaotic scenes are seen as undeniable proof of the fragility of democracy there, while they also mark an extraordinary moment in the American history.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said it is possible that members of Congress could face prosecution if found to have aided and abetted the violent attack on the Capitol earlier this month that left at least five people dead. Justice is called for as we address insurrection perpetrated against the Capitol last week, the Democratic Speaker of the House told reporters on Friday, 15th of January. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Joanne Grieve. The piece is titled, Nancy Pelosi Says Lawmakers Who Aided in Capitol Attack May Be Prosecuted. Stay with us for more of Joanne Grieve's article. The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said it is possible that members of Congress could face prosecution if found to have aided and abetted the violent attack on the Capitol earlier this month that left at least five people dead. Justice is called for as we address insurrection perpetrated against the Capitol last week, the Democratic Speaker of the House told reporters on Friday, 15th of January. If in fact it is found that members of Congress were accomplices to this insurrection, the Democratic Speaker said, if they aided and abetted the crime, there may have to be actions taken beyond the Congress in terms of prosecution for that. Pelosi's comments came after Mickey Sherrill, a Democratic congresswoman from New Jersey, said she saw colleagues leading groups on reconnaissance tours of the Capitol just a day before the riot on 5th of January. More than 30 Democrats have signed on to a letter spearheaded by Mickey Sherrill seeking more information about the tours that took place at the Capitol on 5th of January. At the press conference, her first since the House impeached Donald Trump for a second time over his role in encouraging the pro-Trump mob, Nancy Pelosi announced there would be a review of Capitol security. She said retired Lieutenant General Russell Honoré was being tapped to lead the security review of the U.S. Capitol in the wake of last week's deadly insurrection. Retired Lieutenant General Russell Honoré is perhaps best known for overseeing humanitarian aid efforts in Louisiana following Hurricane Katrina. Nancy Pelosi said Honoré would conduct an immediate review of security and interagency interaction and Capitol command and control. Pelosi would not provide specific details on when she would transmit the article of impeachment to the Senate. They're now working on taking this to trial, the speaker said of the impeachment managers. You'll be the first to know when we announce that we're going over there. Once the Senate receives the article, the chamber must begin a trial to determine whether the president should be convicted and removed from office. Though the trial will probably conclude after President-elect Joe Biden has taken the oath of office on 20th of January, a conviction could prevent Donald Trump from running for president again. A handful of Republican senators have already criticized Trump and signaled that they have not decided whether to support conviction, but at least 17 would be needed to break ranks to convict Donald Trump. Meanwhile, the Justice Department Inspector General announced on Friday that it was launching a review of the department's role in the riot. The Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, said his office would assess whether there are any weaknesses in Department of Justice protocols, policies, or procedures that adversely affected the ability of the Department of Justice or its components to prepare effectively for and respond to the events at the U.S. Capitol building on 6th of January. The Justice Department has already opened 175 criminal investigations in connection to the Capitol riot, and that number is expected to surpass 300 by the end of next week, according to a federal prosecutor. Speaking at a press conference, Michael Sherbin, the acting U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, said his office was exploring more significant felony charges against those involved in the Capitol building riot. Michael Sherbin said there were also growing indications that law enforcement officers, both current and former, participated in the riot. "We don't care what your profession," Sherbin said, "we will charge you and you will be arrested." Stephen D'Antuono, the FBI assistant director who leads the Washington field office, said even friends and family of the rioters were providing tips to the FBI. Stephen D'Antuono said, "You might want to turn yourselves in instead of wondering when we're going to knock on your door, because we will."
European News Bulletin.
Hello and welcome to another European News Bulletin with me, Robert Carter. Tonight we will be exploring the biggest news stories, but also taking a look at what's trending on social media with my colleagues a little later on. But first, let's take a look at tonight's top story. Hundreds of people have protested outside a police station in Cardiff, Wales, for a second day following the death of a black Muslim man. Mohamud Mohammed Hassan died hours after he was released from police custody, chanting "No justice, no peace." Demonstrators made their way to the police station, demanding justice and an investigation into the 24-year-old's death. Mr. Hassan was arrested on Friday evening after reports of a disturbance at his home, but was released the following morning without charge. His family have accused police of abusing him whilst in custody, which they believe led to his eventual death. Well, for more information on this, let's go to Lee Jasper now, a former London mayoral advisor who has campaigned against racism for many years as well. Mr. Lee Jasper, thank you so much for joining me, sir. Firstly, I just want to ask you if you can tell us a little bit more about these accusations against the police.
Well, they are not accusations, they're matters of fact. The fact is that Mahmoud was perfectly fine prior to his arrest, and after his release from his arrest, he was clearly battered and bruised, split lip, tracksuit splattered in blood, as well as having severe bruising all over his body. That's the fact of the matter. He was met by his auntie on his release, who urged him to go to hospital. He said he was tired and wanted to sleep, and therefore went to rest and was found to be dead when they tried to rouse him. So I think the facts of the matter are very clear. He was fine before he went under arrest, and he was clearly the worse for wear when he came out of the Cardiff Bay police station, and subsequently he died. Those are the facts of the matter.
Now, I've read a piece you've written about this case so far. It seems as if the police are not handing over the CCTV footage, which they should have as part of their uniform, of what actually happened during his detention, I believe. Perhaps you could just update us on that. Any likelihood of getting that anytime soon?
Well, we're looking for the public to support our demand, and there's a public petition to that effect calling on them to release the video footage. If the police have got nothing to hide, there should be no problem in releasing footage of his arrest, his transport to Cardiff Police Station, his detention in Cardiff Police Station, and his subsequent release the following morning. And we're demanding that as a matter of course, and to address the acute and extreme concern of the general public in relation to what happened to him, that those videos should be released immediately. And we're calling on the Independent Office of Police Complaints to do so.
Now, I believe you've been in touch with the family as well. If that's true, perhaps you could tell us how they're coping following the death of Mr. Hassan.
Well, they're deeply traumatised, as anybody was. He was 24, he was expecting his first child. He'd moved recently from London to Cardiff. They've lost a beloved son, a cousin, an aunt, an uncle. So you can only imagine the tragic loss and sense of trauma that the family is going through at the moment. So it's deeply saddening to see them in such pain.
Now, in the little time that we have left, I'll call upon your years of experience. For our international audience, does the British police have a problem with using brute force against minorities?
They certainly do against people, black people, people of African or Caribbean descent. Although we make up only 3% of the population, we make 16% of the total people who are arrested using police force, according to the Home Office data. We're also disproportionately targeted through racial profiling by the police service, who, as an institution, have a culture of institutionalised racism that executes profound injustice on our communities on an almost daily basis.
Well, thank you very much, Lee Jasper, for speaking to us about this story. We will be following it as it develops, for sure. Well, we're heading over to the social media world now, and my colleague Ahmed Caballo has been assessing what's been trending online today. Let's bring him in now. Ahmed, what have you got for me?
Yes, I mean, there's been a fierce reaction online. A lot of people are talking about the protest and the fact that 200 people who were outside Cardiff Bay police station basically forced this issue and forced the newspapers and the journalists and the media organisations to stand up and pay attention to what looks like another unjustified death in police custody. Now, what's angered so many people, as Lee Jasper has mentioned, is if the police have got nothing to hide, why won't they show the footage? And on social media, we're seeing different people saying different things. And a lot of people are saying that if Black Lives Matter movement was not just a kind of fade in history, something that was a hashtag that happened last year, if it's something sustainable that really shook the conscience of the British public, then they should care what happened to Mr. Hassan, and they should be speaking up about his death. So I've got a tweet from Kasim. He says, if you said Black Lives Matter last year, if you supported the protest, if you learned about white supremacy, if you started a reading group, if you mourned Black Lives or you mourned statues, now is the time that matters. Now, we've got a VT from a friend of Mr. Hassan, who was there, who's outraged about yet again the lack of accountability amongst the police officers when someone dies shortly after being in their detention. Let's play that VT.
He was about to become a barber. They don't care about that. They care about the colour of his skin. If I kill a police officer, I get 25 years. If they kill us, they get a suspension. We don't need that. No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
So it almost appears as if this is turning into some kind of British version of the George Floyd killing that took place in the US last year.
Yes, I mean, the problem is people look at police brutality, systemic racism, as something that happens over there in the United States, far away. But the UK has its own problem of systemic racism, of a lack of accountability. Since 1990, there's been over 1,000 deaths in police custody, and not one police officer's been held accountable, even when the evidence has shown that the person didn't offer no threat or did not have a gun, such as the case of Mark Duggan, that started the 2011 riots here in London. Now, Amir has come with a tweet. He says, his family and friends told me he recently got married and his wife was expecting a child. It's absolutely heartbreaking for the family. Hopefully justice will prevail. Justice for Mahmoud. And this is an important point. Sometimes when black people from ethnic minorities, they die in police custody, we think about the way they die and we kind of strip away the life that they had before, the fact that they meant something to their community, to their family, and so on. We've got a human rights lawyer that's asking some pressing questions about the circumstances surrounding his death.
Why was he, upon release from Cardiff Bay Police Station, battered and bruised? And why did he die so soon after being released from Cardiff Bay Police Station? And is there any link to the injuries that he sustained that had any cause to his death?
Okay, Ahmed, we just have time for one more tweet and then we'll have to move on. Now, what do you have from the online world?
So a tweet from Neil says, a lot of anger in Cardiff, and rightfully so. A young man is dead and there are serious questions about what happened to him while he was in police custody. We need justice, transparency and accountability, and we need it quickly.
We do have to leave it there for now, but thank you very much for bringing us the additional information on what is turning out to be quite a story of massive public interest here in the UK. Thank you. In other news, British researchers have declared that ethnic minorities should be considered extremely vulnerable to COVID-19. According to their research, systematic racism has meant that people from ethnic backgrounds were twice as likely to die from COVID-19 than the UK's white majority population during the first wave of the pandemic. The report explains that people from ethnic backgrounds are much more likely to work in high-risk jobs, which exposes them to COVID-19. Which in turn leads to the higher rate of infection, hospitalization, and death. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has received the coronavirus vaccine produced by China's Sinovac company in a bid to set an example and encourage others. The move comes after reports suggesting the efficiency of the Chinese vaccine is close to 50%, significantly lower than its Western alternatives. Erdogan called on other political leaders and lawmakers to set an example for the rest of the country. More than 50 million Sinovac doses have been ordered, and a Turkish-made vaccine is expected in May. Progressive voices in the US Congress have been widely criticized after refusing to follow strategies to force a vote on Medicare for all during the ongoing pandemic. Robert Inlikesh explains why so much of the US left-wing public are unsure on whether or not to trust the Democratic Party.
The U.S. progressive cry to bring Medicare for All to the U.S. Congress for a vote has been ignored by the Democratic Party's AOC and fellow progressive representatives. Knowing that these same self-described progressives will willingly vote for expanding the U.S. military budget, but never break from their party to grant a substantive policy change in favor of the U.S. public, is it time that we stop viewing these people that say things we agree with or look like us as instant allies? Progressive show host and comedian Jimmy Dore first came up with what became known as the hashtag Force the Vote campaign, in the hopes that the Democrat politician Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would leverage her vote for Nancy Pelosi to be re-elected as Speaker of the House. Nancy Pelosi is a pro-war, anti-Medicare establishment Democrat who has a large part to play in not fighting to grant U.S. citizens stimulus payment checks at crucial stages of the ongoing pandemic, whilst allowing trillions to go for corporate bailouts. Jimmy Dore proposed that if AOC threatened to withhold her vote in the House for Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, if Pelosi would not grant a vote for Medicare for All, then others would follow suit. In fact, it turns out that the vote to elect Nancy Pelosi did turn out extremely close, and just a few votes would have made a difference. However, AOC went back on her past promises to fight for Medicare for All and decided to shield pro-war Pelosi from having to push for a vote on Medicare for All. Instead, AOC and Democratic Party-funded progressive media went on the offensive against Jimmy Dore for suggesting that the self-described progressive use her political leverage in order to get a vote passed on a bill passed in pretty much every other developed country. With the progressive movement now split by this controversy, many taking the side of Jimmy Dore have been left in despair about the lack of real progressives actually fighting for policies to help the U.S. public. Also, the question has been posed as to why the public should value people who talk a good game and claim a certain identity, as this has turned out in almost all cases in U.S. politics to be absolutely meaningless. Ultimately, politicians are supposed to represent the people who vote for them. People should not vote for someone because that person looks the part or is a good actor. It should be on policy. If that politician they voted for then refuses to push for what they received public support to do, they should no longer be in power. Yet for some reason, people continue to believe in these figures. The same can be said about the right-wingers who support the likes of Donald Trump. Trump was arguing to end the wars and to push a conservative agenda aligned with the values of his supporters. But once in office, the swamp he claimed to be poised to drain became his bath. Whilst U.S. politicians approved billions for the U.S. military to blow up black and brown people all throughout the global South, U.S. so-called progressives continue to obsess themselves with having as many black and brown faces in office in order to do that exact same thing. The reason why it is supposed to be a good thing to have diversity, to have representation of minority communities and radical political thought in government, is so that we can see them represent those views of the communities in question and political movements. If they don't, there may as well all be white men sitting in there in white robes in DC offices, because at least then the enemy is transparent. Progressives have to fight in order to win in government. Just sitting there and getting on camera now and again for attention and to virtue signal, in fact, only works to pacify the left, because they come under the illusion that they actually have real representation.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
The British government has rolled out many different schemes to fight the COVID-19 pandemic's onslaught on its economy. The supposed goal is to avoid mass redundancies and unemployment. But where are the billions of pounds needed to sustain such efforts coming from? The Bank of England is now under scrutiny for printing vast amounts of money, which economists say will further increase inequality in the years to come. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of Britons have been sent home by struggling businesses and employers to sit it out. To prevent a spike in redundancies and mass unemployment, the government has introduced a furlough scheme to pay 80% of their wages up to £2,500 a month. In August 2020, the Eat Out to Help Out scheme revived the hospitality industry a little, and businesses have been offered grants to keep their heads above water until spring. But many might be wondering where all this money is coming from. The truth is, the Bank of England is using quantitative easing to keep government borrowing costs down. In other words, the bank is printing money for the government to spend.
The adverse effects of the Bank of England printing more than £450 billion to get the country out of the COVID-19 crisis will be felt in the very near future and by ordinary working people, because most of this money will invariably end up in the pockets of the rich and influential, and very little will trickle down.
Whereas before, money flowed in a circular fashion in the economy, with ordinary workers paying mortgages and bills to property and business owners, who went on to spend that money on more assets and living the life, money is now flowing on a straight line from the Bank of England, where it's being printed, into the pockets of ordinary working people and then into the pockets of the rich. By the end of the 2020 to 2021 financial year, the UK is expected to set the highest recorded level of borrowing in peacetime history.
The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs. So you're looking at something where at the moment is a sort of the pumping of the money is keeping the thing alive. But as soon as you start ending these programs, the realities of a collapsing economy, not just in the UK, the yellow vests, Brexit and Trump are all the result of a fundamental insecurities going on right the way across.
After the pandemic, the rich will go on to buy more stocks and bonds and property, and the surplus money in the economy will lead to its devaluation, pushing ordinary people with fixed salaries further down the economic ladder. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Germany's Foreign Minister Heiko Maas has accused US President Donald Trump of having trampled democratic rules by denying the outcome of the election and inciting his supporters to storm the Capitol last week. Maas said such incidents should prompt democracies to examine the enemies within and call out political leaders who incite violent rioters to undermine democratic norms. He also highlighted the use of social media to spread lies. Twitter and Facebook both recently made headlines when they removed the outgoing president from their platforms. Well, our final section on today's programme takes us back over to social media, only this time with my colleague Robert Inlakesh. Rob, your first story takes us over to Yemen, I believe. Apologies for that. It appears we're having some audio issues. However, I'm sure Robert Inlakesh will be joining me once again very soon. The topic which we are going to discuss will be the ongoing war on Yemen. Obviously, the United Nations has issued a stark warning to the US following their designation of the Yemen's Houthi Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist organization, which they plan to do this month. The UN has warned that if the US goes ahead with this move, then it could lead to a famine in the region, the likes of which hasn't been seen for over 40 years. I believe I have Robert Inlakesh back on the line. Let's bring him in now for more on this story. So, Rob, I just introduced your story. Perhaps you could give us the details. What's social media saying?
So we're going to go straight over to social media right now and look at what people have been saying online to what you've just outlined there, a horrific circumstance. First of all, we've got from Anthony, who says, all to spite the Biden administration and hand a parting gift to Saudi Arabia, etc., Secretary Pompeo will go down in the history books as one of the most loathsome, villainous, evil people to serve in any capacity at the State Department. I hope you suffer what you've prescribed for millions. We've got another one here as well who says, it's absolutely tragic. It's unbelievable that the Trump administration could have a star. Wait, no. This started under Obama, Biden. Oh, shoot. Yeah, Trump didn't help it. Trump is awful, etc. Lock him up. But this only happened because Obama started supporting it first.
Now, Inlakesh, I have time for just a little bit of analysis from you on this. What do you think is going to happen with Yemen once Biden comes in?
Well, this is an interesting one. Many are speculating that Joe Biden wants to try and get back into the JCPOA and also negotiate to have a peace settlement inside of Yemen. If that is going to go ahead, he needs to undo this this designation of Ansar Allah as a terrorist organization and also its leaders as well, or else it's virtually impossible for it to get done. And also, if he is going to allow for aid to continue to go to Yemen via U.S. charities, the United Nations, then he has to undo this move. So all eyes on the Biden administration coming into power in just under a week now.
Well, we have to move on to your second story now, but an equally interesting one. It's an area of your specialty, Robert, I believe.
Yes, and interesting developments that we're seeing inside of 48 Palestine, or what some people would call Israel. Netanyahu attempted to go and deliver a speech inside of Nazareth, which is populated primarily by Palestinians, and was met with large protests as he attempted to do this. What was interesting to see is that Palestinian Israeli citizens, members of the Knesset, were dragged off, who were prevented from even going to the protest. They assaulted Palestinians, grabbed Palestinian flags away from them. This is part of an ongoing trend that we're seeing inside of the occupied Palestinian interior, that we are seeing that Palestinians who are citizens of Israel are rising up on a more frequent basis now, are more angry with the Israeli regime for the way it is treating them. We're seeing this in the Nakba. We are seeing this in Haifa right now, with daily protests ongoing over the Israeli police shooting of an innocent Palestinian, they say, who did absolutely nothing wrong, drove past police, and of course did not injure a police officer. And incidents like this, where we see even members of the Knesset being attacked as well. Netanyahu was attempting to garner votes, and that doesn't look like it is likely. And it also, as well, goes to show that the Palestinians inside of Israel, of Israeli citizenship, are making a difference in that they are voting for the Arab parties inside of the Knesset, and they pose a problem for Israel even forming any type of government, because Netanyahu and his competitors will never accept to include them inside of a government so they can occupy a lot of space.
Well, we've got a little bit of time for that social media reaction, Rob. Perhaps you could tell us what people are saying online.
The first one we've got here commenting on this says, Israeli police tackles at joint list members of the Knesset and prevented them from attending the anti-Netanyahu protest in Nazareth. We've got another one here as well from a user called Noga, who says, Netanyahu's Nazareth visit, addressing himself to the same public he recently called terrorists and a fifth column. He called on the people there to embark on a new era. He was met with major protests. The police arrested about 10 people, including Knesset members who are immune from arrest.
Well, we are out of time. There is a lot more to say, unfortunately, but thank you, Robert Inlakesh, for your time today. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The article you're about to hear under the heading A New Polio Vaccine Joins the Fight to Vanquish the Paralyzing Disease has been authored by biomedical writer Amy Cunningham. Stay with us for more of Amy Cunningham's article. We'll be right back. After decades of work and mass vaccination campaigns that have spared millions of children from paralysis, the world is close to wiping out polio. But a small number of outbreaks that have simmered in areas of low vaccination remain. And some happened after weakened virus in the oral polio vaccine, over time, moved around the community and regained the ability to cause disease. No other vaccines made with weakened live viruses have caused outbreaks of disease. To stamp out vaccine-derived polio outbreaks, the World Health Organization, WHO, has granted emergency use for a new polio vaccine. The oral vaccine got the go-ahead on 13th of November. "We are very, very enthusiastically looking forward to using this new vaccine," says medical epidemiologist Chima Ohobunwo of Morehouse School of Medicine at Atlanta, Georgia, who has worked on polio eradication in Africa for more than two decades. Along with continuing the crucial work of improving vaccination coverage in places where it is low, the new vaccine will hopefully take us to the finishing line of polio eradication. 8 years after the World Health Organization's 1980 declaration that the world was free of smallpox, the Global Polio Eradication Initiative launched to tackle polio. The disease was a promising candidate for eradication. An effective, easily administered and cheap vaccine was available. And poliovirus, which naturally infects only humans, doesn't hang around in other animals in between outbreaks. Most people who become infected with poliovirus don't feel sick, while some have flu-like symptoms. But about 1 in 200 becomes paralyzed for life. In the late 1980s, wild poliovirus paralyzed more than 1,000 children each day, according to the Global Polio Eradication Initiative. Since then, thanks to widespread vaccination campaigns, cases have plummeted by more than 99%, and two of the three types of wild poliovirus have been eradicated. The last cases from type 2 and type 3 were reported in 1999. And 2012, respectively. Only wild poliovirus type 1 remains, and only in two countries. As of December 30th, 56 cases were reported in Afghanistan and 83 cases in Pakistan caused by type 1 poliovirus in 2020. Much of this progress has been possible because of the oral polio vaccine. "It's been the workhorse of the eradication campaign," says virologist and infectious disease physician Adam Laring of the University of Michigan School of Medicine in Ann Arbor, Michigan. "Immunization with the oral vaccine has prevented more than 13 million cases of polio since 2000, according to the World Health Organization. A big advantage of the oral vaccine, which is made of live but weakened poliovirus, is that it is not only protects against paralysis, it also can stop wild poliovirus from spreading in a community. Poliovirus moves from person to person when someone ingests water or food contaminated with a virus-containing stool. The oral vaccine prevents wild poliovirus from multiplying in the gut and being passed on. While the oral vaccine has nearly wiped out wild poliovirus, it has a vulnerability. Weakened poliovirus in the vaccine has genetic changes that keep it from causing disease. As vaccine virus multiplies in the gut, it can lose key genetic changes, bringing it closer to behaving like wild poliovirus. And altered vaccine virus can be spread to others and establish community transmission. Biologists Raul Andio of the University of California San Francisco School of Medicine has said, That can be a problem if not enough people have been immunized against polio. More than 80% of children need to be vaccinated to keep poliovirus from spreading in a community. The first vaccine-derived polio outbreak to be detected occurred in the Dominican Republic and Haiti 2 decades ago in areas with low vaccination. Today, vaccine-derived outbreaks are primarily found in Afghanistan and Pakistan and countries in Africa. Most of these outbreaks, which have been responsible for more polio cases in the last few years than the remaining type of wild poliovirus, are linked to vaccine virus type 2. Vaccination campaigns, which had used an oral vaccine containing weakened versions of all three types of poliovirus, switched to using a formulation with just types 1 and 3 in 2016. However, the way to stop a type 2 vaccine-derived outbreak is with an oral vaccine containing only the weakened type 2 virus. And that has sparked new outbreaks, researchers reported in Science in April. It is this vicious circle, Loring says. As of 22nd of December in 2020, there were 854 polio cases linked to the type 2 vaccine virus. Hence the quest for a new and improved poliovirus type 2 oral vaccine, one that kept the good parts of the original, but with tweaks to try to prevent problematic genetic changes. It's a wonderful vaccine, so we didn't want to change the characteristics that induce the body's immune response, Dr. Andino says. The only thing we wanted to do is prevent the reversion to a disease-causing virus. Poliovirus can swap pieces of its genome with related viruses called enteroviruses. So the researchers moved a string of genetic letters the virus needs to make more copies of itself closer to the gatekeeper modification. That way, if the vaccine virus was able to ditch that modification by the way of a swap, it would lose this necessary string of genetic letters too and die out. Finally, the team tinkered with the enzyme that RNA viruses, including poliovirus, use to help replicate themselves. The enzyme is sloppy and can introduce a lot of genetic changes, Andio says. That's advantageous for the viruses, which are continuously trying to adapt to a new environment, he says. Andio and colleagues modified this enzyme in the vaccine virus to introduce fewer mistakes so the virus cannot evolve so quickly. The new oral polio vaccine was shown to be safe and to produce an immune response similar to that seen with the original vaccine in infants and children, researchers reported. The hope is that the modifications will slow the evolution of the new vaccine virus such that it can end the existing outbreaks without creating new ones. The vaccine-derived outbreaks are a significant yet surmountable hurdle to polio eradication, says Uhuru Bonyu, and science is helping. But the key to ending polio is very high vaccination coverage. Obstacles including war, migrating populations, difficult terrain, and lack of vaccine acceptance have created pockets of inaccessible children, he says. Reaching all children requires engaging community leaders, providing culturally sensitive information, and finding out how to meet other community needs, says Ohua Bonmu. For example, whilst working in Nigeria, he and his colleagues made progress with nomadic populations. It meant sometimes combining vaccinating their children with vaccinating their animals. The nomads' cattle would be immunized against brucellosis and anthrax bacterial infections. Protecting the animals also protected the nomads from these infections, he says, and motivated their cooperation towards having their children receive polio vaccine. A win-win situation. Polio eradication has been a long